Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, corporate warfare. How are we supposed to counter ESG and woke capital? Vivek Ramaswamy joins us for that. What's the latest out of Durham? Cash Patel, fan favorite of this program, helps us navigate it. Email me, freedom@charliekirk.com. Support the Charlie Kirk Show at charliekirk.com/support. Get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com. Turning Point USA chapters change the world. So go to tpusa.com, start a high school or college chapter today at tpusa.com. And as always, you can email me your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com. That is freedom@charliekirk.com. And support the Charlie Kirk Show at charliekirk.com/support. Come to our Student Action Summit with the biggest speakers in the entire movement, including Trump and DeSantis there. Brought to you by Turning Point Action, tpusa.com/SAS. Where else can you hear Trump and DeSantis? It's pretty awesome. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For personalized loan services you can count on, go to andrewandtodd.com, the wonderful andrewandtodd.com. We have a great guest with us right now. He is an expert on really what's happening on the corporate space. There's an entire corporate war happening that gets some coverage. It gets a lot of coverage in the Wall Street Journal and CNBC, but it doesn't always get covered on political channels or on programs that are just kind of talking about the news of the day. But if we do not stop this incredibly insidious campaign called ESG, we're going to have a corporate landscape that is not just not competitive, but it's almost like a social credit score for companies. It's a little bit of a complicated topic, but it's incredibly important for our nation. So joining us right now is Vivek Ramaswamy. Vivek, welcome back to the program.
Good to see you, Charlie. How you doing?
Doing great. Thank you. And you are the author of Nation of Victims and the executive chairman of Strive Asset Management. Vivek, can you walk us through what is ESG?
Yeah, that is a great question to ask because the proponents of this movement have made it impossibly difficult to actually define. One of the things I've been doing is holding that movement to task for what it actually stands for. So the short answer is it stands for environmental, social, and governance factors that are supposed to influence how capital is invested in the economy. What does that mean? It's anyone's guess. But what it has come to mean in practice is that there is one political end of the spectrum that is representing its views in corporate America using the investments of everyday Americans to do it. So I'll make it really specific for you. What's basically happening is a small group of asset managers who pledge allegiance to this philosophy, ESG, firms like BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, three of the largest asset managers in the world right there, together managing over $20 trillion. That's more than the GDP of the United States. What they do is they aggregate the money of everyday citizens, probably many of the listeners of your program included in that, maybe you and I too. And what they do is they take our money, but then they invest in monies in companies across corporate America and tell those companies that you have to abide by these climate goals, that you have to abide by these emissions caps, that you have to abide by these diversity, equity, inclusion standards and racial quota systems in your boardrooms. And if you don't, then we're going to fire you as CEO. Then we're going to take seats on your board. Then we're going to cut your pay. And that's the lurking variable behind the woke capitalist epidemic, yes, which is really the capital behind the scenes that's forcing companies through shareholder pressure to adopt these one-sided politicized agendas. So there's a lot more to the story, but at a high level, Charlie, that's how it works.
Yeah, so just to kind of boil it all down, so ESG is something that is supported by the World Economic Forum and by the Davos crowd. And effectively, on its surface, it sounds really good, environmental, social, and corporate governance. And I heard somebody in some clip recently, I was watching some advertisement, and it was really weird. In the first 10 seconds, they said, we all know that business needs to play its role in trying to make the world a better place. I said, that's weird. I thought you're in the role to just sell products and kind of turn profits. I didn't think of you as a social activism organization. And it's kind of been this bifurcation of mission, I believe, because of cheap money policies and the hyper corporate influence in our government. These companies have so much time on their hands and extra money. They're like, oh, yeah, okay, we'll do $200 million towards this. But it's even more insidious than that, isn't it? Because, please, your thoughts.
I was just going to say, it is a lot more insidious than that. I agree with you that easy money policies have played a role. There's a lot of causes. That's why I wrote my last book all about was Woke Inc. But, you know, look, I think it's more insidious. And this is what I want to point out is what's really happening here, Charlie, is that you have lurking state action behind the scene. So what the ESG movement has allowed, effectively the progressive movement to do in this country, is to allow government actors to do through the back door what they could not get done through the front door. Let's take the Green New Deal, for example. There was not enough political support to get the Green New Deal done through the front door of Congress. So what they did is they deputized companies BlackRock.
Right. Yes.
Just like they do to big tech, by the way, but to force use asset managers to enforce these values through the back door. So it is politics, but it's politics in the avatar of the free market. And this is a threat to both capitalism and democracy, right? A lot of Milton Friedmanites, and you know, I'm sympathetic to this. I agree with it to some extent, worry that this makes companies less effective. I think that's definitely true. I've seen that firsthand, and I have a concern about it. But the real problem is that it is a threat to democracy. And that's the part that the left especially misses, but the left and the right both miss. Because what this says is the questions that we should be sorting out through free speech and open debate in the public square as citizens in a democracy, whatever we think those right answers are, we should sort them out through the political process. We're instead working it out through force, using capital as a vehicle of force in the private sector to decide on one monolithic view of how to fight systemic racism or how to fight environmental challenges like global climate change, by enforcing one orthodoxy and using capital as the vector to do it. That's the real threat to democracy.
Well, and this is, it's so interesting. I mean, I grew up steeped in libertarian economic literature. I learned a lot from it. I don't agree with a lot of it anymore. I mean, the price system, all that stuff is fine. It's fair. You could read von Mises, Human Action. It's all interesting. But never in any of their literature do they talk about how an economic climate could then actually have state-like power and totalitarian impulses. I mean, this is more of a philosophical question, but it's a stunning new development, isn't it?
It's a uniquely 21st century version of this problem. And as I often say, I used to call myself a libertarian too, Charlie. I don't anymore.
No, nor do I.
Part of the reason why is that the free market cannot fix what it is not free to fix. Right now, what you have is lurking state action. The SEC, the Department of Labor, tilting the scales of what companies can and can't do. And then when companies then respond to those regulations by enforcing a one-sided agenda, using market power and market force to do it, the other side says, hey, you guys wanted free market capitalism all along. This isn't the government delivering those solutions.
Right.
It's the ESG movement. It's the large asset managers. It's BlackRock. It's the capitalists, the guys that the Republicans wanted to support all along. And I think the thing that's missed is that they have taken on the avatar of capitalism itself as the vehicle for pushing a political agenda, even though state action is the lurking demon behind the scenes. And I think they dupe both sides into submission. See, liberals used to be skeptical of corporate power. Think about Citizens United, et cetera, 10, 15 years ago, 12 years ago.
Occupy Wall Street.
They used to be skeptical of corporate power. But what they said is, no, 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 don't worry about it, guys. We're going to use that corporate power to advance the neo-progressive identity politic, climate change obsessed philosophy that you guys love. So you shut up. But to the Republicans, you shut up too, because you guys always said the free market can do no wrong. Well, guess what? Both sides are duped into submission, and we see the rise of this new Leviathan that is far more powerful than what Hobbes envisioned, than what George Washington envisioned, than what Ronald Reagan or Milton Friedman envisioned. This is a uniquely 21st century problem that demands new dogmas to address this uniquely modern demon. And I think that that's a big part of what I've been focused on, is providing clarity to say we can't just recite slogans we memorized in 1980 when the unique problem we face is not just government, but a unique hybrid of government and the market that together can do what neither one can do on its own. That's the real threat that the conservative movement needs to wake up to.
Yeah, I don't think Jack Welch hated America. I do think Jeffrey Immelt hates America. Big difference. I mean,
yeah, generational difference.
And that's just one example. And to your Hobbes point, yeah, I mean, people can be very nasty, brutish, and short to one another. And that can infect corporate America as well. And something I want to explore with you with this new dogma is, what do we go about doing to solve this? because it seems as if we're stuck in this paralysis. Well, we don't like government and we don't like corporations. So then what do we do to actually go about making this issue or mitigate this issue, I guess you could say. But I just want to reemphasize this, though, which is the wokies, they've always cared about power. That is the postmodernist philosophical construct. They only care about power dynamics. And someone 20 years ago, either intentionally or unintentionally, realized, they said, oh my goodness, the corporations are actually more powerful than the federal bureaucracy. So if we can infiltrate and take over the corporations, it's running the whole country. And it's one thing to take over the FBI and the CIA. We're going to keep on doing that. But to take over Google, to take over Goldman Sachs, now we really can make America in our image.
Yeah, so look, I think that, you know, the issue here is that you have this waterfall of political accountability, all right? We were talking about how the state is really using private companies to do through the back door what they couldn't do through the front door. Back in the 1980s, the problem was they used to delegate it to the three-letter acronyms like you were citing before the break, right? FBI, DOJ, you name it. What's happened is back in 1980, this is what Ronald Reagan tried to fix, was the delegation of congressional lawmaking authority to this alphabet soup of the federal government. FBI, DOJ, SEC, FTC, you know, FDA, FCC, the list goes on. What we're seeing today is actually the governmental delegation of power to a new alphabet soup, GOOG, FB, BLK, GS, the kinds of AMZN, MSFT, the kinds
That's
of companies
so
that actually are insulated
exactly
from political
right.
accountability. So the question is, how do we solve this problem, right? I've spent time writing books about this. You talk about this on air. Talking about it's fine. I think seeing the problem with clear eyes is important. How do we solve the problem, right? And I think there are multiple categories. There's no silver bullet. I think there are legal solutions, right? I think if people bring cases in court claiming state action when the government has goaded a private company to do something that the government couldn't do, there's actually really good Supreme Court doctrine. And, you know, I know you like to go deep on this stuff, so we can talk about some of the Supreme Court doctrines mm-hmm. that say that if it is state action in disguise, then actually the Constitution still applies. If they tell a big tech company to take down content that's First Amendment protected and the government told them to do it, turns out you can actually sue the big tech company as a state actor under theories of state action doctrines developed by the Supreme Court. I think you do something similar with what's going on with BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard with the ESG movement. So there's this legal track that I think more people should pay attention to. I think there's a lawmaking track that, I mean, I have pounded my head speaking to Republican lawmakers in both the Senate and as well as the House about this, and none of them, you know, they all say they love it. Very few go on to do anything about it. I think that political belief should be considered to be added to the civil rights statutes as a protected class. And I would have never said that 10 years ago, my old libertarian version of myself. But what I've learned, Charlie, is that actually what happened is the civil rights statutes protecting classes on race, sex, sexual orientation, religion, national origin, what they did was they were expanded over the years to include claims like hostile workplace environments and harassment, which in turn started to interpret certain viewpoints as being discriminatory to those protected classes. So actually, there were an interesting pair of cases. You couldn't fire an employee at Whole Foods if they were wearing a BLM mask, but actually you couldn't not fire someone for wearing an All Lives Matter mask. Say what you will about the underlying philosophies, it's actually the civil rights statutes and their expansive interpretations that created the very conditions the rampant political discrimination we see in the private sector. So I say that if you can't fire somebody or deplatform somebody because they're Black or gay or Muslim or white or Christian or Jewish or whatever, then you should not be able to fire somebody or deplatform somebody just because they're an outspoken conservative or an outspoken liberal. Let's actually really treat these standards even-handedly. Either we get rid of the protected classes altogether, which maybe I could get behind. I certainly could have gotten behind, but I think it's not politically feasible. Or you apply those standards even-handedly by adding political belief to the list, right? So I think that's a conversation we ought to be having.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, the civil rights regime is just so messed up. And Caldwell's book, Christopher Caldwell's Age of Entitlement, is the best book on this. It's a profound piece of literature that talks about how the civil rights agenda is completely different than what people actually think it is. It's different than what people thought they were getting. And so talk just for a second here. Do Republicans get the threat here, or do they just kind of just roll over? Your thoughts?
I think they mostly don't get it, but we'll see if we can sort of guide them to focus in the right place. I will tell you, though, Charlie, I've hung the jersey on that, forgetting about the legal and political solutions. I think one of the most promising paths are actually market solutions. So that's why I founded this firm that I'm running now, Strive Asset Management, competing directly against BlackRock, because it turns out that most Americans who actually have capital, who have savings in their account, hardworking people who actually have investment and buying power through hard work and their savings don't want these values represented with their capital. They would rather have their capital invested by asset managers exclusively to make great products.
Yeah.
And so that competing, I think, is actually a much better
This is what's so smart, right? So, and it's not just everyday people. For example, why doesn't the North Dakota Pension Fund invest in your firm and not in BlackRock? That's when you're actually going to start to change things, right? Is the pension
State
funds.
State pension funds are key.
Yeah.
And that's a whole, we could have an hour discussion about that. It's such a broken system with a managerial class.
But the pension funds are what drive this, because you have hundreds of billions of dollars. Unless you're completely corrupt or know what you're doing, you're going to get a 5 to 10% return, right? Just by volume of the assets, you hire enough people that graduate from Princeton with mathematic degrees, you're going to figure it out. But if you could get all of a sudden these red states to put their pension funds for their police, their teachers, their firefighters into an asset firm like Strive or whatever, anywhere, just buy municipal bonds. Just don't have it go to BlackRock. You help save the country. All right, we're out of time. Vivek Ramaswamy, thank you so much. Terrific commentary as always. One of the most important things happening in America that doesn't get enough attention. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With us right now is a friend of the program, Kash Patel, former DOD chief of staff and author of Plot Against the King. Kash, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
So what's going on with Durham? Danchenko is standing trial in the fall. What's the latest out of the Durham investigation?
Yeah, look, you know, he's prepping for trial. You're correct. He's going on trial in Virginia in the fall, I think September, October. And what prosecutors do and what I did as a former federal prosecutor is you issue trial subpoenas. So the latest flurry, 30 witness trial subpoenas were issued by Danchenko. Now, that's a big case when it comes to federal prosecutions. Usually you can tidy up a federal criminal prosecution with about 10 to 15 witnesses. This is 2x that. So he doesn't have to call every one of those, but he means to tell the court and the world that he's flying in witnesses from around the country and around the world to make his case against Danchenko. And so hopefully we'll get more information as we get closer to trial with the pretrial pleadings and motions that the defense and Durham will file. And hopefully Merrick Garland will allow John Durham to continue his work on other cases, even though I've heard rumblings of otherwise.
6 years, Kash. It's been 6 years since the actions of Peter Struckstroke Smirk and Lisa Page, the lover, the adulterers, have been sending those text messages in the summer of 2016 saying they had a secret plan, a backup plan, an insurance policy, if you will. Where are the other indictments, Kash? My patient is running thin. As you know, it's kind of a recurring theme. What's going on here?
I know your patience is running thin, and now we're to the point where mine is too, which
Uh-oh.
Is kind of upsetting.
That's not good, everybody.
I know that's not good, but you know, I thought there was going to be two more FBI agents indicted this summer. That seemed like the track that John Durham was on. And look, I might be proven wrong by the end of the summer, but it looks like Merrick Garland is weighing in and not astute. He's being astute. He's not saying don't bring prosecutions. I've heard he's coming in to say it's too close to the election, so you got to hold powder, right? Which is this DOJ's hypocrisy at its height.
It's always
don't hold powder when it's, you know, for Hillary Clinton, but you know, fire away if it's against Donald Trump. And you know, that's just a two-tier system of justice, which I was proud to be a member of, and now I could not be more ashamed to have ever been a federal prosecutor at DOJ.
Yeah, Peter Navarro, Steve Bannon stands trial, I think Monday, for his contempt of Congress. Is that too close to the election? Attorney General Merrick Garland? No, of course not. It's actually helpful. So I'm going to actually just take a little bit of a tangent here. It's pure speculation. But do you think that Donald Trump might be indicted by the Department of Justice?
No.
Why?
There's zero chance.
Zero chance. Okay. Tell me why.
Zero chance.
I'm not saying he did anything wrong. No, I'm just I want to be very clear.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I understand. That's a question a lot of people are asking me on nonstop on Truth Social. But this is what the January 6th committee has been working for. And you know this better than anyone. They want to get a set of impeachment charges, which are ultimately lead to a conviction in the Senate. So Donald Trump can never hold office again. Okay. That's their goal. Their side out for the publicity's sake is let's gin up in the media possible charges, which are being led by Adam Schiff about this, you know, so-called insurrection. But it's a legal impossibility. Donald Trump authorized, and I was there in the Oval Office as chief of staff, 20,000 National Guardsmen and women 2 days before the January 6th events. It is a legal impossibility for the commander in chief to authorize the security of the Capitol and at the same time lead an insurrection. That's why I'm at zero.
Yeah, I'm very worried about DC jury pools and errant prosecutors, right? And so it's very telling. So to kind of combine all that together, I mean, just I'm kind of go back to Durham. That was a little bit of a tangent. Do you think we're going to see something soon, or is it just going to kind of be more of the same? Or at this point, like, what crumbs are you seeing that could lead us towards something significant?
The crumbs are, you know, the trail he left during the prosecution. I know the result was terrible in the Sussman case, but the reason that we created DurhamWatch.com, it's a database for documents that for anyone that's interested. We put all the January 6th documents up there on the Jan 6 vault, all the government documents from the government agencies themselves that they won't show you, all the Durham pleadings. And I think we'll get a flurry of action similarly in the Danchenko case as we get closer, and we'll get the public will at least be educated on the actions of Christopher Steele, even more so Hillary Clinton and her campaign, Fusion GPS and other, you know, I call them criminals at the FBI, McCabe, Comey, Strzok. And Glenn Simpson over at Fusion GPS. So, you know, the public has owed its the public is owed accountability in the form of judicial indictments and convictions. And at least the only thing we can provide outside of government is the actual paperwork. And we're going to continue to put it up for free at DurhamWatch.com. It's just the least we could do.
Yeah, I mean, people are becoming cynical, and cynicism is not good. You cannot live in a country for long at peace if people are cynical. They believe, I mean, you see what's happening. I mean, I don't know if Hunter Biden will ever be held accountable. I have my doubts. I think part of it is just try to way to keep Joe Biden controlled. But you have just kind of these, quite honestly, paper indictments. I mean, it's just kind of just little stuff. It's like paperwork compared to the massive conspiracy that existed. And I am skeptical that justice is ever going to be administered the way it should. I want to ask you about some foreign policy stuff, Cash, with your experience. You're the former chief of staff to the Department of Defense. So Joe Biden is in Saudi Arabia right now. He gave a fist bump, I guess, to Mohammed bin Salman, which is just a joke. So he said this is because of COVID. Look, everything in the Middle East is very murky and gray. What do you think, Cash, is the proper approach to American foreign policy in the Middle East? It seems like we can get so ensnarled in this. What are we missing from Joe Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia?
The biggest problem is Joe Biden is putting us back into a Middle East posture from the 90s and the Persian Gulf stages. The problem is he started off by annihilating American energy independence that Donald Trump started. And that's what you see at the pump every day. You don't have to be an oil tycoon to figure this stuff out. If gas is costing $7 a gallon, and it's a direct result of Joe Biden shutting down the Keystone pipeline, the XL pipeline, and turning on Nord Stream 2, which was built by Russia to give Germany, our biggest ally, basically free energy and access to data. These have direct consequences. And when he can't take it anymore over here in America, he, with the hypocrite that he is, after he called MBS a pariah, after the Jamal Khashoggi murder, and, you know, I remember that familiar. I got sent to Riyadh, you know, the next week after that happened to figure out what was going down over there. And now everyone in the mainstream media is quiet about Jamal Khashoggi because they are hoping that Biden goes over to MBS and begs for oil for America. And here's what's going to happen. MBS is in the driver's seat because of our failed diplomacy.
Of course,
we are not going to get any cheap gas or oil from MBS. He is going to get demands from the rest of the world and probably Russia and Syria, who he's had their dictators visit his country to the detriment of America. And we haven't even touched upon how damaging this is when it comes to Iran and their rise in the world through the Middle East powers.
Hey, look, again, Saudi Arabia has plenty of skeletons in their closet, to say the least, probably behind 9/11, incredibly corrupt through and through. The operative question always seems to be, what's best for your country? And if you keep Saudi Arabia in a neutral position, it could harbor energy production towards China. It certainly puts the Iranians on defense. And so, but it seems as if there is there's this Washington, D.C. consensus traditionally against Saudi Arabia all the time. And now it just seems like all of that has really calmed down. And Joe Biden has no leverage whatsoever in these conversations. Zero. Largely not. Because of ideology. So, Cash, I want to ask you, there's a lot of elections happening right now. What races are you looking at? What candidates are you behind? Where do you think the America First agenda has the best chance of success in the kind of as we're ending the primary season right now?
Well, let's start with the great state of Arizona. Of course, I'm a huge champion and proponent of Carrie Lake, who I've endorsed, my first gubernatorial endorsement. I think she's America First candidate who understands border security and the need for national security priorities and putting American citizens first. Similarly, I endorse Blake Masters. He's going to be the next senator of Arizona. We're going to flip that seat with the drive and leadership of Donald Trump to make him his candidacy front and center, just like he did out west in my home state of Nevada to Adam Laxalt. We're going to do similar out west. We're going to take the West back and we're going to take America back while we do that, because we have people who care about the border, people who care about economics, and people who care about tramping down illegal narcotics that are killing our youth at record numbers due to Chinese fentanyl flowing in from Mexico. And I know Arizona was excited to have President Trump here. Yep. But he had to push it a week because of the, you know, the loss of his the passing of his ex-wife. So
really sad.
It's very sad. And he's doing OK. And, you know, like the trooper that he is, he's just going to push it a few days and he'll be out west with us in a week or so.
It's actually a better date to drive a late uptick for Blake and the other endorsed candidates, as you mentioned. And then he'll be at our Student Action Summit the next day. So he hates cancer.
Oh, yeah.
People, but
that's great.
It's family comes first. It's tragic what happened. Kash Patel, thank you so much. Deeply appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie. Have a good one.
We have been telling you for some time that we believe that there is the new COVID strain that is going to be used as the surprise heading into the midterms. Let's play Cut 84, CBS with Nora O'Donnell. The new BA.4 and BA.5 variant, play Cut 84.
The urgency is due to the explosive spread of the latest Omicron variants, BA.4 and BA.5, now responsible for more than 80% of all new COVID cases.
BA.4 and BA.5 are our most immune-evading variants yet. The virus is mutating so quickly and rapidly, it is changing so dramatically that your immune system will have a harder time fighting off this current wave.
Do the vaccines have negative efficacy? Why aren't they still talking about therapeutics? Azithromycin, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, intravenous therapy. Go to Cut 82 about how the deaths are mounting with BA5, play Cut 82.
We are experiencing about 300 to 350 deaths a day. That is unacceptable. It's too high. And we will continue to use the infrastructure we have built and the tools we have to lower suffering and death as we manage BA5.
What tools exactly do you have available? Look, all the vaccine makers are now saying their Omicron updated jabs have great efficacy, but we know they don't. In fact, Anthony Fauci has even admitted that they don't work very well. Play Cut 70.
One of the things that's clear from the data, that even though vaccines, because of the high degree of transmissibility of this virus, don't protect overly well, as it were, against infection.
Don't protect overly well. Doesn't sound like terrific grammar. The coronavirus mutates quickly, and is anyone saying the vaccinated population versus the unvaccinated population? So is the vaccine a treatment? If it's a treatment, then why does it get liability protection against adverse events and effects? If it doesn't protect against infection, it's the first vaccine that doesn't have the sort of guarantee of 90, 95, 99% protection against infection. Stunning official Canadian data now shows vaccines raise the risk of death from COVID. Vaccinated people are now more likely to be hospitalized or die from COVID, even after adjusting for the fact they're older than the unvaccinated. In May, the most recent months for which figures are available, only 9% of COVID deaths and 14% of hospital admissions in Manitoba occurred among unvaccinated people, even though they're 17% of the population. Manitoba, which has about 1.4 million residents, also provides figures that are adjusted for the fact that vaccinated and boosted people tend to be older. Those show that in May, vaccinated but unboosted people were 50% more likely to be hospitalized or die of COVID than unvaccinated people. People who had received boosters had roughly the same risk of hospitalization or death as the unvaccinated. This is from Alex Berenson, Manitoba, Canadian data, May 1st through May 31st. And yet we're still kicking people out of the military for not getting this gene-altering therapy that they call a vaccine, even though Canadian data shows that they actually might raise the risk of death from COVID, which, by the way, is perfectly consistent with the predictions made by Dr. Peter McCullough, by Dr. Robert Malone, and Dr. Zelenko, may he rest in peace. Remember, Democrats need crisis and they need emergencies. Is this about health or is this about control? Is this about an emergency to give an excuse for mass mail-in ballots? Is this about having an excuse to be able to get a midterm push? Thankfully, a judge just blocked the Air Force discipline over vaccine objections. But Republicans are too busy wringing their hands. To kind of tie this all together from last week, what if Republican governors said, if you're fired by the federal government or discharged from the military based on vaccination status, we'll happily hire you in the Arizona Border Patrol or in the South Dakota National Guard? Why are Republican governors going along with this? Are they purchased by Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson? It's a fair question. Don't fall for it. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thanks so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.